there and welcome to the Thank You Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. It feels good to have the gang back in the room, I think. It's, you know, it was kind of fun recording by distance and having a lot of guests who we, you know, if they showed up on the Thank You Fellows, it would usually be like a once every other year ordeal just because traditionally, we've always recorded this show in person, even when we had guests. And it was, for a while, it's never been because of technological limitation to do it. It's always been about the feel of the show. And part of it is also, it's hard to host a show with five people on it yes. or more when one of them's on a phone call, getting that talking
room. Yeah, they're always slower to respond.
And so, you know, we were kind of thrown into figuring that out. We figured it out for a couple months, but it's nice to not to come back to the familiar format. If you're listening for the first time or you're a new listener, Thank You Fellows is part of the 1517 Podcast Network of shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcast to check out the entire catalog. And yeah, you can just go to 1517.org generally to see more of what we do. This Thinking Fellows is a piece of a broader essentially network of resources. So we have publishing house, blogs.
I like to call us the flagship of a carrier group.
The flagship of a carrier group.
You're the admiral.
We're going to well, you know, if you want to call me admiral, I probably wouldn't say no.
So, yeah, you know, we have a large archive of podcasts, blog articles. We have a whole publishing house full of books. You know, we publish, what, Adam, 7-8 new titles a year-ish?
Yeah, we always plan. Well, last year we plan to try to go down to 5 or 6, but it always jumps up.
Yeah, that's the same with podcasts. You know, the last 2 years I've planned 0 new add-on shows.
That's what you have to do. You have to plan for 0 growth and just handle the growth that happens.
Yeah, you know, one of the things is that it's a good thing. People are excited about what we do and our ability to expand on that. But that does mean, yeah, you got to be ready for unplanned growth every so often. But that's a good thing. So today's episode. Oh, actually, you know what? I'm gonna make Adam do something awkward here for a while.
Oh, does he know this?
Does he know this?
I can't
no.
wait.
I never know anything, Adam, until it happens live.
Adam, it feels like just yesterday we were announcing that you were coming on as the head of publishing. And Thinking Fellows was your full time gig now, along with helping with the books.
That'd be awesome. That was just it.
So now, where are you going, Adam? You're still going to be on the Thinking Fellows, but yeah. What are the plans for your future?
I'm moving. Oh, I've taken a position at Concordia University in Chicago, formerly River Forest, Concordia University River Forest, as assistant provost of. Make sure I get this right. Mission and identity. So the Lutheran identity piece and you know, working with faculty.
Did a millennial write your
existing
title?
And I don't know, but existing and future faculty recruiting and those sorts of things.
Good.
And then next year everything's kind of up in the air with the COVID-19 and all that, but next year they're restructuring. They're going to have a College of Theology, Arts, and Humanities that I'll be dean of.
So. That's great. Founding dean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Will your office have to move?
I have no idea.
You're going to move in, and then 9 months later, they're going to move you to another place?
Well,
I don't think so.
We are sad to see you go, but I do. It sounds like it's going to be an exciting move for you, and you're going to get to help shape a new department at the university, which will be a fun opportunity. And for listeners who are concerned because they like...
I'm teaching too, by the way.
How much are you teaching?
I don't know yet. I think 1-1.
Yeah.
Yeah. Class this semester.
But as I was saying, people who enjoy having Adam on the show, he's still going to come on to the Thinking Fellows in person when we have travel opportunities. And also now that we had to figure out the whole Zoom call thing, we can have Adam on by distance. Too.
By Zoom.
Yes. And so I'll be sending him some equipment, better equipment than he's had for the home recording during COVID.
That's good. You can teach him how to use it.
And we're going to teach him how to use it, and then it'll sound like he's in the room with us, even though he's halfway across the country.
Thanks.
Or you could just fly me out every 2 weeks to Southern California.
We should do that. I'm sure that'll fit with your schedule really well.
So last episode that we recorded...
I think you're going to be running from a meeting back to your office like sweaty because it's humid in Chicago throwing on your headphones to log on Zoom.
The worst thing about all of this is the weather. You know, every morning I walk my dog on the beach.
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, those days.
Walking on Lake Michigan. Lake Michigan.
Dodging bullets. Riots.
I'll cut that out if you want. So last episode, back on track, guys, back on track. We talked about church and state, faith and politics. So we're going to follow this theme here, and we're going to do faith and reason, faith and science. How do these two interact? Do they interact? Should they interact? I think that's a question that many people throw up in the air now, right? Is that they should, there's a proposition that just like the political one, that they should be totally separate. You can have faith in one realm, politics in the other. I think I'll let Rod open this up again too, because he talks about his background in the sciences. And I think you have been in the realm of science and reason, and you've been in the realm of faith, and somehow you find these two compatible. So how do we do this?
Well, it was Dr. Montgomery that bridged the gap for me. He had no idea, but my whole background, 3 years out of four, was the sciences. I was going to do medical school, and just as my father had done. And he died at Mayo Clinic in very early open heart surgery, and everything went up for grabs. I was at the University of Washington at the time, and I was sort of thrown into it. But I couldn't shed my background. That was impossible. I went to seminary, and there were two of us out of 70 who had a background in science. I had one, and one other guy from Duke, and had been accepted to Duke's medical school and had come to seminary as an unbeliever instead. Wow.
Came to seminary as an unbeliever?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Can you even imagine that?
What a waste of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing guy. I led him to Christ, and that was new for him.
Wow.
While he was at seminary. But anyway.
So many stories. You think you know all of Rod's stories.
So he became a believer at seminary, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wowza.
Yeah. And anyway, when I was at the Springfield Seminary of the Missouri Synod, after giving up on biblical criticism after a year of it in every class, it happened that Dr. Montgomery was flying in. He was at Trinity Evangelical at the time. He was flying in to teach evening courses once a week. And a friend of mine said, "You've got to sign up for this course." And I said, "A course? I'm behind in everything, and it's only the first week." He said, "Well, you can still get in." I said, I'm already behind. Why would I add a course?" And he was like the woman in Matthew, and he wouldn't stop. And he finally said, "Well, call your wife and tell her that you're going to sit in tonight." I said, "All right." He wore me down. And that was a whole new world because Dr. Montgomery knew it so well. A few weeks into that, I stayed after class a few minutes, and I said, "Am I going to have to write off all my training in science?" And he said, "Heavens no, you'll use all of it. Come on in." That was new. I had never heard a Lutheran theologian have that kind of a view of science before. And, of course, later on I realized he was primarily going to argue the truth of the gospel from fact. I hadn't run into a lot of that either. But neither had my classmates, because they had no science in their background. So he was doing two things at once. But that sort of reasoning, after course after course after course after course with Dr. Montgomery, got into my blood. And then I passed it on to all my students as best I could when I was a professor. That the best way to argue for the truth of the gospel is to argue it from the facts, not from the rationality of the other arguments. So that's a short sort of synopsis.
I think I'm not sure I know exactly where you're going with this episode, but I have a feeling we're going to get into some of the modern day issues, and that gets frustrating for me, because in some of this, I don't have the extensive background in sciences that Dr. Rosenblatt did, but all through high school when I was actually attending, and then my first 2 years of college, I was going to be a biologist. That was the end goal, to do cetacean biology, and the you know, the search for empirical evidence before coming to a standing conclusion on an issue was sort of drilled into me through various AP science classes and then early work in Cal State San Bernardino in biology and chemistry. And when you meet Rod, and I don't know what Adam, I'm sure Adam had a somewhat similar experience. You meet Rod and you're taking apologetics classes and philosophy classes and, seeking out information inductively and empirically, not jumping to conclusions just based on quote-unquote rational reasons for doing so or rationalistic reasons for doing so. Man, it's a mind-blower to know that you can study theology and maintain sort of an empirical approach to doing so. That's a game changer. And it, for me, it made it so that I didn't have to check my, because my early experiences with Christian theology were such that you really had to sort of check your science brain at the door.
Yep.
Or even just your empirical brain at the door.
Yep.
Before entering the room. And when I met Dr. Rosenblatt, and that wasn't the case, that was one of the first things that absolutely, first couple classes, I did have 4 classes with him in the first semester, but just the first couple of classes, really, it's inspiring, to be honest with you. And sort of the same story he tells by meeting Dr. Montgomery and being inspired that he's not going to have to give up all of his background in searching for evidence before believing something, betting one's life on it, it changed my world. And so I have a deep affection for science as we get into this. I have a deep affection for sort of an evidence-based epistemology. Very much drawn to that, often to the consternation of my spouse. If we get to the point where I go on a rant against scientism, just know that it's not anti-science.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, Adam, you wanted to do this episode. You sent this as a suggestion to me. And so
we made Adam pick
the last couple episodes here.
Last couple episodes.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, why were you thinking about this? What was going on that said, I think this would be worth doing?
Well, I think it's one of those issues that's perennial or permanent. It just always comes up. And we did that. We did an episode, I think it was just us. It was you and me and your dad. Maybe it was over Zoom on expertism, I think was the title.
It was expertism.
Into, this is right around when the pandemic began. Yeah. And
when we were all taking our marching orders from Fauci.
Yeah. But it's always an issue. And then like we said last episode, maybe this is the cynic in me, but I look at the sort of political unrest right now and what I think is the philosophy behind it, this kind of Marxism of a sort, and how unreasonable it is, drives me up a wall. It's almost Gnostic, in a sense. Mm-hmm. So I just think, and I learned this from Dr. Rosenblatt. A lot of my experiences in the academy and elsewhere have suggested that this is a big and important issue for Christians, figuring out what the relationship is between faith and reason. And it's extremely important for Christians to be comfortable using their reason in the right arena.
Yeah.
I mean, Luther, I always go back to Luther's explanation of the first article of the Creed, where he says, I believe God has created me and all creatures, my body, my soul, my eyes, ears, and everything else. And he's given me my reason and my sense experience and still preserves them.
Yeah, that's a great, great translation, by the way.
Yeah. I looked at a different translation online before just to make sure I had it right and it was wrong. So right off the top of my head, bam.
Nice.
Anyway, and then like you said, Scott, I remember back in the day at Concordia Irvine, I had just gotten out of the Navy like a month prior. I was dumb as a box of rock. I mean, I could shoot, I could swim, and these sorts of things. But
I could shoot and swim.
My first class at Concordia was Hebrew at 7:30 in the morning.
Whoa!
And whoa. I had no idea.
Oh, that's my the best gosh. Time to do a language.
I could barely read
let's
English.
Let's be real. It's like there's nothing that'll sort of prepare you for doing a language more than waking up at 6:30.
What? Well, I was an early bird anyway. But
what academic advisor was like? Give the freshman Hebrew.
I just remember getting there and about 15 minutes early.
Because you had 2 years of each. You had to do
it. Yeah.
You didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
But I was there probably at parade rest. I don't, because I was still, you know,
parade rest.
Coming out. Coming
off like my
that.
Brain wasn't civilianized but, yet.
So I had a semester of Hebrew and other courses. And then I went to sign up for my second semester. And I had heard about this guy named Rod Rosenblatt. But I didn't have a course with him. And so people were like, you got to take a class. So I go to my advisor and I said, hey, I want to take, I think it was apologetics or maybe it was doctrine. And she goes, why do you want to take that?
Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy.
I won't say who it is, but.
Lordy.
We wanted to kind of shield you from Dr. Rosenblatt.
And, can I guess the initials?
No.
We all know it.
Okay. I have to say, I think we've talked about this before in the air. I mean, that course, Christian Apologetics, Philosophy of Religion, and there was a few others, were game changers. Not just in terms of just the way you approach things or think about things, but in terms of, like, evangelically, the confidence that you have to speak the gospel to somebody, knowing full well you can answer questions that are going to come back, and you can even anticipate what they're going to look like. Is a game changer in terms of
afraid.
Your ability and your just your confidence to speak the gospel to people. I remember. I mean, I'm still. I don't know if people can tell on the air, but I'm very shy.
Oh, they can tell.
And antisocial.
Don't forget cranky.
And no, I'm not cranky.
Okay.
But I remember after apologetics, we would go to UCI. The University of California, Irvine, a mile down the road, they had this sort, it wasn't called a free speech zone back then, but they had something where everybody
what we would call it today.
The Wiccans and, you know, mm-hmm. and we went once a week and mixed it up with these people. Mm-hmm. I would have never done that before that class.
Sure.
I mean, people would ask me, so in the Navy, for example, I run into odd people and they'd ask, what do you believe? And I'd be like, I don't know. So now it's like, you couldn't shut me up. So, it's not just the content, it's more of the disposition, the approach to facts, comfortable with the fact that Christianity is not just comforting because it forgives sins, but it's comforting because it's first and foremost true.
Right on.
And if it's true, you can mix it up with anybody.
Yeah. Yep. I think it's funny.
Well, except for the marks.
What I've noticed a lot, especially lately, and this has been off and on in my life, I've noticed this, is that when you're sort of an evidentialist, so a Christian who believes that there is enough evidence to reasonably believe this stuff is true, or to even think this stuff is true, based on the available data, right? You get it from both sides in this, right? Because from the secular side, you know, they certainly don't see you as somebody who has a belief that's based on evidence or facts, like you said, Adam. And from the Christian side, you're almost seen as, some sort of weird person who needs to rely on worldly epistemology when they should just listen to the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, where's your faith?
Where's your faith?
Yep.
And it's a... Rod used to say all those years ago that sort of he, you know, or at least allude to the fact that he was in this precarious position at the university. And as an undergrad, you're like, I don't understand that. You're like the best teacher I've had. But then you get past that a little bit and you sort of see perspective from his perspective that, you know, from both sides, you're getting it. You know, it's just interesting. I remember doing an onstage thing with one of the science teachers at the university several years ago. Where he sort of, and this is just sort of his personality, I think. I don't think it was a real conviction of his, but questioned one of the things that I said, which is, you know, he asked what we've said on the show before, the Ken Ham question, is there any circumstance that would cause you to change your belief? And I said, yes, of course. If Christ, you know, hadn't raised, I'll go with Paul here, I need to at least rethink my position here. And he said, well, that's not true. You just say that because you know that you're supposed to say that. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing because that's a scientist sort of treating my evidence as though it's a belief not based on actual evidence. And I'm just sort of using that. But that's an a weird example of sort of, you get it from both sides when you have an idea of faith and reason where, you know, your faith isn't just epistemology, but there are epistemological framework. There is an epistemological framework that undergirds your faith.
Yeah. So there's kind of two questions that I was thinking this episode could go to, and one of those is the faith reasonable? And I think we've answered that pretty sufficiently.
Yeah.
things before. And I guess the other one, and you guys have already gone for it here, is is reason allowed to then operate within the realm of the faith? And this is this might be a little trickier. Is there a place where there is a dividing line, or is there a proper place to this? How do we deal with, and I think we've answered this question before, but we should do it again, Luther on this particular area, for instance, of his caution against reason, or as we've translated it here, philosophy systems.
It's centered on Aristotle, and every Lutheran seminarian learns at least one quote about Luther's hatred for Aristotle. And it's about all they learn of that, but it's always built in there. Luther was objecting to Aristotle being the substance of what Christians believe.
Could I even just ask a clarifying question? I'd even say Aristotelianism.
Yes, fair.
More so than Aristotle.
Fair.
And I think this is, you know, a couple years ago, back when we were still in the garage, we did an episode like this, and Rod said that most Christians don't understand that there's a difference between epistemology and faith. And that was, you know, it's kind of funny. He'll all of a sudden, known him for going on 30 years, he'll all of a sudden say something I hadn't heard him say before, and it sort of, a little light goes off in my head, and I'm like, yeah, that's absolutely right. Because when the faithful people hear you speaking about epistemology, they think that you're somehow...
not spiritual.
Not spiritual, or you're deriding faith.
Yeah.
And when the secular people hear you speak of faith, they think you're deriding evidence, you know, at that point. And I think that is just, there's a difference here. And I think Luther was on to it. And I guess that's what, to pick up where you're saying, he was on to it. And I think one of his biggest complaints was not Aristotelianism being a thing or Aristotle's teaching.
No, he has praise for Aristotle.
Being referred to, but that there's a difference here between sort of the help that Aristotle tries to give epistemologically with something like the idea of the fourfold causes. There's a difference between that and, you know, utter reliance on Christ that eases the terrified conscience. Yeah. They're not the same thing. And when the church of his time was trying to make them the same thing or make them work together too closely even, he saw that the church was falling into error. And so he reacts, as Luther often does, by bombastic statements and says, reason is the devil's whore. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, there's a certain segment of Christianity / Lutheranism that believes reason is the devil's whore.
Yes.
You know, without sort of the greater idea of what he meant there.
Yeah, I guess one of the ways you could kind of think about this is Christ's death on the cross atone because it makes sense within a philosophical system, right? Because death should atone or something like this. Does it atone because that is what God proclaimed would be the atonement for sin. And so you have this cross. Now, it doesn't mean that it didn't happen and that we can't use our reason to ask, did that death on that cross actually happen? But then imposing a philosophical system on why that happened, or then what the mechanics about the way that works behind it.
I'll tell you what Christians for centuries ought to have thought about questions like that and didn't. Stay as close to the biblical text as you can.
Yep. It's the only available evidence to answer that question. And that's the thing. When you start thinking it from an evidential mindset, you can blather on for 10 minutes if you want to about the possibilities.
Yep.
And make yourself sound smart and use every $5 word that your expensive education bestowed upon you. But it's at the end of the day, unless you are referring to the text of Scripture and the words of Christ and the Lord through the inspired authors regarding what he says is going on in atonement or justification, you are simply just spouting conjecture.
Well, and that's, you know, that's what we Luther gets at in some of their early disputations, is actually particular philosophical conjecture about justification and the way the cross works and the way the creature relates to it. And, you know, we've all, I think everybody contributed to the chapters in the Heidelberg Disputation book here. Rod did the chapters on 20 and 21, which deal exactly with this, which is that the way that this atonement works, the way where you find God actually is totally against the way you would think to find God,
yes,
which is in natural, philosophical, reasonable things that God's found somewhere where if you reason to God should be, he's not, right? So if you reasoned where God should be, it wouldn't be dying on a cross.
Yes.
Yeah. But, so there's a tension here with this where that's not setting your reason aside. That's actually listening to the word of God about what happened there, where God is found. It's clear. And then we can ask that question empirically. What was that God?
Sure.
And that's what ends up happening here.
Think of the strange verse, I forget in which gospel. Some Greeks came to the disciples and said, we would see Jesus. What in the world? Wow, what? How odd that is. No revelation. Mm-hmm. They're non-Jews. And something that they had heard led them to come over and ask the disciples they'd like to meet him. That's not the sort of thing you'd ever expect.
Yeah. Yeah. And to get to Rod's point that, you know, theologians through the ages should have asked, what does the Scripture say on some of those things, is that there's a reason for that, right? If you look at this from the testimony of Scripture, Christ is making particular claims about his authority, and that claim is that he's actually God.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, that can be shown to be the case.
And the Jews got it.
Yeah, and if that can be shown to be the case based on the available evidence, then what he says is by necessity more authoritative than what you or I say.
Yep.
Which is why when people undertook to write down his words, that then is the available evidence to the answer to the question.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know where we started with this. Seems like on faith and reason.
Well, think about it. Think about thinking a priori about what an atonement would be.
Yeah.
A priori.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions that would have to be made.
All of it
that
we see in the movies, everything that we see like that is still riding on Christian revelation.
Right. It's informed by this as it's been
all of it.
Yeah.
All of it.
So I want to transition a little bit here because we talked about it before the show. I think we've brought it up tangentially on episodes. We've talked about the idea of scientism, and to draw it back to what we're talking about, I think this is actually a good example of some of the warning of what Luther was getting at here, which is that reason will become your faith. Reason will be what your faith is trusting in, clinging to. And so with scientism, we're actually talking about basically a system of religion that is...
It is.
That it relies on reason or empiricism or whatever, or maybe doesn't rely on those things but claims to.
Yep.
So, Dad, I know you're talking about this all the time. If somebody wanted to like define what they mean or what we mean on the show by scientism...
Well, I'll say something, then I'll have Adam correct me if I go wrong here, because he and I talk about this stuff all the time. But I would generally say it's the spirit of the age where the idea of science is appealed to rather than the particular scientific data in order to make decisions. So a political leader comes out and says, we are going to do this or that, and the reason we're doing that is science. Mm-hmm. Right, and off behind them will be somebody in a white lab coat giving us the impression that this white lab coat person has been asked and has given answers that are then, you know, the policy decisions are being relayed to us on behalf of science. That is scientism in sort of a broad sense as I see it. You see this a lot, or you hear this a lot. I mean, we heard it a lot during the pandemic. We hear it a lot on issues, say, like climate change and whatnot. Now, it doesn't mean, just because I call that scientism, doesn't mean that those people are wrong.
Correct.
Right? It doesn't mean that if they say, science tells us global warming, blah, 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 it doesn't mean they're wrong.
Right.
It just means that's not actual science. That's an appeal to authority. The authority at this point being, quote, unquote, science. They could, by chance, be right. But it's not like they're giving us the scientific evidence and asking us to draw a reasonable conclusion from the evidence, which would be good, science.
Good professors who teach intro courses in science try to get across that it's always a moving train. And if they're really good, they get across to the students it's probability thought.
Yeah, which makes you wary to make broad, sweeping, 100% mm-hmm. conclusions.
Yes.
So when you, the more you hear somebody in the name of science make a definitive conclusion that's very broad-reaching, the less scientifically based it likely is. Scientists will say things, you know, that are giving you information based on scientific evidence.
It is likely that.
Yeah. Well,
so yes.
Might be.
As far as we have, you know, the available evidence that we have today,
yes.
It's likely that X, Y, and Z, this is happening because of X, Y, and Z, or this might happen.
Yep.
But you'll hear a lot of qualifiers in there.
Yep.
Because it's empirical, and you don't know.
You'd be surprised that when you dive into this, even with things that we think are concrete, like medicine, that, like, if you look at why does ibuprofen work, and you look at scientific literature about that, it is believed that these mm-hmm. drugs work because, mm-hmm. but it always starts with that phrase, it is believed that.
Yes.
It might be down the line that further evidence or investigation of the way drugs work or as our medical technology improves, that it works for an entirely different reason than we believe today.
But in our day, politically, we're being asked to make tons of decisions based on a reference to science rather than science. And that I think is much like being asked to believe some theological principle based on a reference to what a priest said, or something like that, or a papal fiat. It's much the same thing. And I guess my point is that the more culture has divested itself of solid theological information based on the available data in the Holy Scriptures, you know, the more they've taken to listening to just a substitutionary set of priests that we call scientists.
So unless Adam has something to jump on there, I have maybe a prying question for this then. Is it possible, because one cannot presumably be an expert in all things, to live your life to a reasonable degree without these sources of authority that you really can't double check? Like when it comes to science or faith or history or something, you rely on experts at some level for some discipline, maybe not all of them based on where your training is. But how can a person then reasonably decide which sources of authority to go with, assuming or that I'm not wrong and that you do need some sources of authority on issues like science if you're not a trained or work professionally in a particular scientific field?
We just did this, and I don't know if it's released yet, but let me reiterate one of the best pieces of advice I got, from Dr. Montgomery, I think originally via Rod and then straight from the horse's mouth when I went to Strasbourg to study with Dr. Montgomery. It's important to read broadly. It's important if you care about this and you feel the need to have an opinion about it, public or otherwise, to impose that opinion on other people, to try to communicate, teach, or whatever other people. It's important for you to be aware of the available information on data and data on a particular issue, and to be open to change your mind when new data emerges or presents itself to you. That's the best advice I could give on this, is that in one way, we live in an area where there's a cacophony of information coming our way, and the harder thing is not how to get the information, but is how to let go of the bad information. I think, you know, we just happen to have a historian in the room. You know, there are ways to evaluate good versus bad sources of authority.
Yeah, they used to call it, I think the classes back in the 90s and critical thinking classes. Mm-hmm. And they, I think universities, not universally, but have pretty much gotten rid of those courses.
You're going to be a provost. You should bring it back.
Well, this is one of the, I mean, at this time, you'd think that there's like, it's every, well, I'm going to make a general statement, but I think a lot of people are aware now, because of all the conflicting information concerning like the coronavirus, that you need to be able to figure out what source is reliable.
Right.
And you need to be able to think about, you should, it's okay to ask the question. In fact, you should ask the question, well, I wonder what the evidence is behind that.
Yes.
You don't need to know the scientists are saying about plants and human anatomy and physiology, but you do need to be, you might want to learn that. You might be equipped to do that, but most people aren't. I couldn't tell you squat about quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd go to Wikipedia on it, and even then I'd probably be wrong. everybody can think critically.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, well,
it takes some
maybe
training.
98%
it takes some training.
Yeah.
So let me.
But if you just ask the question, well,
how do
you know that?
Yeah.
I mean, just basic questions.
Well, so let's do this. I think this one's interesting. So you talked about the Ken Ham question. That's kind of the question existed before this, but that debate between him and Bill Nye really sort of popularized to the question at the end, the punch. Is there any set of circumstances that would cause you to give up your faith in Christ? What if we applied that question to other areas of life? Are there any set of circumstances that would lead you to change doctors? Is there any set of circumstances that would lead you to change, like to sell or buy a new car, or like to stop driving your car? Is there any set of circumstances that you would change mechanics?
Well, to Adam's point, whatever. Most people do this type of thing. And when I do that epistemology class, I say this all the time. Most people do this type of thing without even knowing they're doing it.
Yes.
They just often fail to apply those same principles to larger issues.
Yeah. Every time they cross the street.
Right. Well, I was just listening to something where it's a British accent, so it sounded much smarter than I'm going to say it. Like even the people in the Chaz, probably have the good sense to step out of the street if a truck is barreling down the road at 30 miles an hour, right? And the most cynical person about the nature of reality will jump out of the way if they're about to get hit by a bus, right? And so most of us know that if we took our car to X mechanic five times, and five times out of the five times it broke down on the way out of the parking lot, you know, maybe it's time to change mechanics, right? And so we do this. We just sometimes fail to apply it to the more sort of abstract things in our life.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you'll hear all the time, if there's like a big medical decision to be made and you're sort of unsure, can I get a second opinion?
Yeah,
you know, these kinds of things.
Can I see the test results?
Yeah, can I see? You know? Can I see the X-ray? Are
can
you sure
tell
we
me
need
what
to amputate?
This number means? You know? Mm-hmm. Ask some questions.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And I think it just applies to a lot. Is there any?
I mean, back in the 50s, 9 out of 10 doctors smoked Lucky cigarettes.
Yeah,
so Lucky cigarettes must be helpful for you. You know, healthy for you.
Yeah,
right?
And we're marketed. It was marketed that way.
That's what I'm saying. Is that, can I see the data?
Right.
You know, ask some questions.
And I think you're right. People do this subconsciously, but as an experiment, it might be helpful to actually think about those when it comes to particular examples in your life more.
Yeah.
Often. Can you think of some things or some places or sources of authority that you go to out of habit and ask yourself the question, what would it take for me to change this? So let's say you read a certain newspaper. What would it take for me to consider reading another newspaper?
One of the, you know, the biggest pieces of advice you can get from like just normal everyday advice from reading C.S. Lewis's autobiography, Surprised by Joy.
Mm-hmm.
Is, you know, that he is the idea of protecting yourself against succumbing to chronological snobbery. You know, this is sort of
can't fall for things that people did in the past because we're
well. They know forward. Even more so that
whatever's modern is superior.
Whatever's modern is superior to whatever's old. You know, and boy, do we suffer from that right now? Oh my gosh! I mean, like morally, ethically, scientifically, whatever was, you know, any hero that was celebrated 200 years ago must be evil. Whatever principle was defended must be abolished. Whatever. You know, it's just down the road. This is classic chronological snobbery. This is simply believing something is better because you believe it to be true now as opposed to what was believed in the past.
Right.
Well, I'll just throw that in.
I mean, we're...
No, it's worth it.
We're close to the end unless somebody has one last thing they want to go for, but I'm pretty happy where this ended up. I can end with the question, what would it take for you to stop listening to the Thinking Fellows?
Probably the fact that we've done two somewhat political episodes.
maybe. Hey, if you made it to the end, thank you for listening to this episode. We appreciate your time, and we're glad that you think listening to this show is worth your time, whether it was just this as your first time or last time, or if you're a regular subscriber. If you'd like to support the Thinking Fellows or 1517 in general, go to 1517.org/donate. Any amount that you can do is helpful, and if you can set up small reoccurring donations, that really encourages us that we have something that is worthwhile and that you want to last and continue.
We're also not opposed to moderate-sized reoccurring donations or larger reoccurring donations.
You do want to add that. That's good. maybe I should just get rid of the size. If you'd like to set up a reoccurring donation, we'd be very thankful. All right. Thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.